From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we visit Philadelphia and Professor Tony Montero. He's a regular with us, and it's been a while since we've spoken with him as we come back online this week. Professor Montero, we've missed speaking with you, and we're looking forward to speaking with you today.
Yeah, good, man, and Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year to you also. So I've been following what you've been doing at the Saturday Free School in Philadelphia over that whole period of time, really. But something you started working on a week or two ago in a series of conversations really piqued my interest, and that is a probing of the role that Hegel played in the development of basically the philosophy of materialism, sort of one of the underlying, sort of one of the foundational ideas upon which Marxism, historical materialism, et cetera, rest, where the conception of the world, of reality, and of human beings was not something grounded in spirit and God, but rather the material world, and those other things actually a product of the material world. Maybe you can explain this better than I'm trying to do on a 10-cent version, and explain to us some of what this means and the role it plays in the world today, and what you've been doing with this at the Free School.
Yeah, you know, you're right, Don. A couple weeks ago, at the request of several of our younger members, we began a study of dialectics, dialectical logic, and of Hegel, in particular his work, Science of Logic. And so we've kind of contextualized what we're doing, not as a retreat from the world of events and the crisis of capitalism and the political crisis in the country, but as a way to further hone our logical abilities to explain both the crisis and what might be some of the ways out of the crisis. And, a second part of this is that everyone knows that since the middle of the 19th century, and you're right, since Marx and Engels, that Hegel's Science of Logic has loomed large in the development of revolutionary thought. I mean, there is hardly a revolutionary or even a radical Democrat that has not engaged Hegel's logic, the logic of dialectics, right, the logic of movement, of the objective world, and all that type of thing. And we could name them off. Of course, I said Marx, of course, Lenin, but of course, Du Bois, of course, Grace Lee Boggs, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. Hegel is a staple in radical thought, maybe up till the present, where so much because of the nihilism of the current moment and of academic thinking, Hegel is no longer seen as important. But it might be a commentary upon the fact that so much of modern discourse in the United States in particular, but I'm certain in all of the advanced capitalist countries, so much of contemporary discourse is not about fundamental change, but about rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. So therefore, if you think in terms of fundamental change rather than just rearranging the chairs on the Titanic, you will be interested in Hegel, the dialectics of history, the dialectics of the material world. If that's not your purpose in life, then you won't be interested in Hegel, and you'll find every way to dismiss him or smear him. So, you know, we have begun, and we begun last Saturday with the reading of The Science of Logic. And we kind of began paraphrasing or appropriating Clausewitz, the historian and theorist of war, who said that war is politics by other means. And we said that philosophy is politics by other means. Mm. That the most partisan, political, perhaps area of intellectual discourse or academic schools and departments, of all of them, there is no more political or partisan area of thought and discourse than philosophy. If you're not interested in the politics of ideas, don't do philosophy, because the stakes are high, very, very high in philosophy. And this is what Hegel understood. This is what, you know, all revolutionaries and radical Democrats understood, that that if you don't get the philosophical questions right, you can't get the political questions right. You're just kind of always stumbling around in the dark, trying to find your way without a compass.
Right. There's an interesting thing that there's an example of that. Marx wrote in the thesis on Feuerbach, and which is on the, and this is in 1845, right? And I think Engels edited. But the essence of it being that people studying philosophy, you know, before, in essence, they were studying it to understand the world. But Marx said the purpose wasn't to understand the world, but to change it. In other words, this isn't some intellectual endeavor. We are engaged in the material world. What you do is going to impact it, or don't do. And so if you're trying to attain an understanding of the world, it's going to govern how you interact with it. And so either you consciously want to change it or you consciously want to leave it alone.
That's right. That's right. And you know, even though philosophy for many, many reasons in the United States has been reduced to a discourse in the closet, a discourse in the corner.
Right.
For Hegel, philosophy was the most important science. In fact, he called philosophy the science of sciences.
Right.
That, in other words, you could not leave the study of physics or chemistry to the physicist or the chemist or the biologist. You could not leave the study of society to the sociologist or the political scientist. The larger framing of all of the issues of science would take place in science, in philosophy. So where you stand on philosophical questions or where kind of determine where you stand on political questions, even on questions of oppression and justice and freedom and revolution in society. So Hegel is huge. And by the way, I should say, we start with The Science of Logic, not with his earlier major work, The Phenomenology of Spirit. Right. That is something quite different than what takes place in The Science of Logic, which is, I think, the revolutionary work, though incomplete and with certain errors, of course, that many people have pointed out over
200 years. Yeah, they've had 200 years to figure it out.
Yeah, 200 years. Well, they figured it out even Marx and Engels and what they call the young Hegelians, right, figured out a lot of the problems 15 years after Hegel had died. Right. And of course, Lenin further does that. And in his Lenin's work on Hegel is called his conspectus on Hegel's Science of Logic, which is worth reading. And then, of course, C.L.R. James, the Trotskyist, also did notes. His notebooks on Hegel's logic are very important. So, you know, Hegel is all over the place. I mean, you know, even though in the bourgeois academy, the so-called liberal academy, you hear more of Descartes or Spinoza or Kant or Schelling or Fichte than you do of Hegel. For revolutionaries, Hegel looms the largest. And, you know, if I could just say one other thing, that in the United States, you know, philosophy is literally thrown in the towel and ceased to be philosophy. Right. Philosophy has turned into film criticism, gender critique.
Right.
You know, everything but what Hegel defined it as. And it's something, and it's a reason for that. And I should, I just want to point this out. You know, Hegel has this reputation among bourgeois and pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist thinkers as being the gateway or the first step towards authoritarianism. You know, they say, for example, why do all of these non-liberal, anti-capitalist, anti-bourgeois democracy right. thinkers like Marx or Mao Zedong or whoever, why are they attracted to Hegel and not to John Locke?
Right. They're saying about, Mills, they're saying about the fascists, too, about the Nazis, that somehow the Nazis are the heirs to Hegel.
I guess so.
It's absurd, but that's what they say.
It's a smear of Hegel.
Yes,
it's
it is.
It's a smear of philosophy to say that he is illiberal, quote unquote. He is not liberal. He is not, quote, democratic. The democratic tradition is the Anglo-American tradition. In some ways, Anglo-Americans, and especially English philosophers and political theorists, they don't even fully accept Jean-Jacques Rousseau or even Voltaire.
Right.
They're considered too radical.
That's right. It's true. It's true. It's true. Also, one of the problems that these have, like those followers of Locke and others, with Hegel, is they ascribe to him a German nationalism that they don't take in context of there's no German nation yet.
No, there is no German nation. But whatever they see, they ascribe the most negative things to everybody that is talking about a fundamental change that would lift the working people from being exploited to being free.
That's right. That's right. And even the tools for doing that, the tools of analysis of the nature of the society people live in are to be denied to them, because you go from that step to the step you're talking about. If I understand it, I'm going to change it.
That's right. That's right. I have a compass, a roadmap, way to think about change that I would not have otherwise.
That's right. Yeah. So this past weekend was the second lecture, I guess, discussion, because it's not really, okay, when you speak, it's a lecture just in terms of how authoritative you are. You're so knowledgeable about this subject matter. It's almost hypnotizing to listen to it because it takes in so much. But these young people there, and some not so young, are brilliant, really. And not only are they bringing questions, but they're fleshing out some areas of things that have been discussed either by you or others there. And just watching it is like, wow, man, I wish I was sitting in that classroom with them. Even when it's not a classroom, it's a virtual classroom. Maybe you could talk about some of the conversation or, you know, the subject matter that's been covered and why you chose some of that to speak with this group. And, of course, people should know for a few months now, the Saturday Free School, which is on Saturdays at 10 a.m., it convenes more or less, pretty close to 10 a.m. Eastern time, is telecast over Facebook under the Saturday Free School's Facebook page.
Yeah.
And so people can listen and also text in comments or questions, then have them discussed or addressed, or in other words, participate in the conversation. And those are archived there also for people that want to see the first two discussions on this matter. Again, the Saturday Free School on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And you know, like you say, to work with this collective of people, and especially this collective of young people, and, you know, granted, most of them are college educated. Some have PhDs in physics and in other fields. Others are just having graduated from undergraduate. And others are not students at all. They're workers, young people. And to work with them is an experience beyond belief. You know, I have taught in many universities, graduate courses and undergraduate courses. There is not a graduate seminar or an advanced undergraduate course that achieves the level of intellectual rigor and intellectual integrity that you find in the free school.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's just in my limited experience, I've never had it sat in an environment like that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was they who proposed that we study Hegel and dialectics. And, you know, it was daunting for me because, you know, I said, yeah, that would be very exciting, but now we have to come up with a pedagogy, a way to set it up, because Hegel is not an easy read. I mean, there are questions of translation, there's questions of him not being all that good of a writer, in my opinion. And then the other question is he's working outside of the box. He's creating a new paradigm, a new framework. So it's very experimental. Even then, you know, in reading it. So it's not easy. So we decided that we would read aloud and that we would start with the two prefaces, the preface to the first edition and the preface to the second edition. Now, these prefaces are separated by many years. You know, the first edition of The Science of Logic was published in 1812. The last edition was published in 1831, months before Hegel dies. So he was working on this for many years and trying to get it right. So the preface to the second edition, to a larger edition, is not quite different, but it's more developed than to the first edition. So we said we would do these two prefaces and the introduction, which itself evolved over the years. So that's what we've plunged into. And in doing Hegel, we have been compelled to go back to Aristotle and the question of the laws of formal logic, which is what we call Aristotle's logic, and what is the fundamental law of dialectical logic? So it's very exciting, I have to tell you. We're all enjoying it, and they're all reading very intensely. There is an excitement that you would never find in a university these days, a rigor that you would never find among students, most students today. And the fact of the matter is, I don't know of very many places in this country where there would be a seminar on Hegel's Science of Logic. Right. And we'll see where it takes us.
You know, I was watching on Saturday. I saw almost the whole presentation on Saturday, the whole discussion. And the part that was really excited me was what you just made reference to when we got to Hegel's, you know, look at logic. And as I recall, the three elements, right? The thing itself, its opposite, and the merged. Yeah,
Aristotle's three laws.
Those are Aristotle's three laws. Okay, so I'm thinking while I'm watching this, I've read some of this when I was 17, 19, 22 years old. A lot of it, actually, compared to most of my peers, and it helped shape my understanding of the world, for better or worse, resulting in this thing that I am, whatever it is. And I'm listening to it now from you, from someone that's been studying it for 50 years or better and looking at the world this way and et cetera. And through the eyes that I have now, having lived, you know, the time from when I was in my late teens, early 20s until my late 60s, and thinking how rich this material is and how if it were possible to somehow, you know, imbue people with this early in their lives, they would be so much better prepared to engage the world.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And you know something, Don? The elite intellectuals who do more to discourage and shut down discourse than they do to free it. They do a lot of damage because things that are readily and easily understood when people join together to collectively discuss these type of issues, they're readily understood. You know,
yeah.
You see a worker, an ordinary person can understand this stuff, you know, but by the time it goes through the mill of these academics and all of their nonsense, by the time they finish with it, it's so obscure and so beyond understanding that it's useless. It's only something useful to a small cadre of academics who really function on behalf of the ruling class in the existing system. You know, Lenin referred to them, these academics, as salesmen,
yep,
of the existing system.
Right.
And that's what they turn out to be. Yep. And they have no interest, and I just want to say this, they have no interest in teaching anybody anything because they are threatened by a mass of people, of working people, who know the world, who can interpret the world, and therefore use what they know to change the world. These academics don't like that. They don't like a challenge coming from outside of the academy. And that's why I think the free school is such a unique phenomenon at this time. We've never fallen or given in to, you know, all of this identity politics and you know, all of the BS, man. We've never given into it. And we've kept our focus upon working people and the purpose of a working class struggle and the purpose and function of ideas within this whole entanglement of ideas and movements and class and race, et cetera. So yeah, we you know, it's let me just, I know I sound a little verbose, but
yeah, go for it.
Yeah, one of the reasons that we were not afraid to tackle the science of logic, because we are not afraid. We are not, there's right. No fear in the free school.
Right.
The young people are very excited. It's always important to work with young people because there's still the spark of hope.
That's right.
Many older people, that's been going for years. And they just, some of them, many of them, I would say, don't have the energy or the excitement to tackle things that they should have tackled years ago. And many of them, like many today, they think that, you know, all you have to do is be an activist. What are you doing? What am I doing? Type of thing. Right. And that's a throwback to American pragmatism, to that fake philosophy called American pragmatism that led nowhere, frankly.
Right.
So that's what I would say. I mean, it's the what you see among those young people is fearlessness and courage and optimism and excitement.
You know, this last phenomenon you're talking about, this American thing, actually, it's pre-Hegelian and Kantian in its content, because the question is, what am I doing rather than what's being done and how am I moving it along? It's individualistic and it's a moral judgment almost rather than one based on performance in terms of attaining certain objective goods for the class, not even putting it, where exactly am I operating? Is there a class struggle involved? Which right. side of the fence am I on? How am I connected to the, is there an effort, a coordinated effort, or even, you know, sort of what, just the impetus of history effort in the class struggle, moving in one direction or another, or where can I put my shoulder against it and push? That doesn't happen. Instead, it's like, you know, is my, you know, vagina hat fitted properly? Is it the right color pink? Did I go to brunch? You know, is this the right person, right pronoun to call somebody? You know, make sure you use or don't use this word or that word or what. All these things that mean absolutely nothing in terms of the class struggle, other than to stupefy people that should be involved in it, making them think that they're doing something. Well, what they're doing is sitting on their hands or worse.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you're very right. I mean, I would say, however, that American pragmatist philosophy goes back to pre-Kant. It goes back to the British empiricists, David Hume and others. You know, by the way, last week, I don't know whether you recall, we talked about Bertrand Russell and his history of philosophy. And, you know, Bertrand Russell was a great anti-war activist and a general progressive for his time. But as a philosopher, he is a real failure, in my opinion. And his history of philosophy, which is not really a history of philosophy, it's a kind of a biography, an autobiography of his dealing with philosophical ideas. And, you know, a big part of this English centrism, or this English Empire predisposition or prejudice of Bertrand Russell's, is a cold-blooded rejection of Hegel in the name of science. Without and you know, Bertrand Russell admits that he never read The Science of Logic. Although,
come on.
No, he never read it. He never read it. And most have never read it. Most in the Anglo-American, the English and American school of philosophy, schools of philosophy, just dismissed Hegel as a dark, eccentric, who only resonated with people like Marx and Lenin, and Bolshevism and that type of thing.
Crazy dissident styles. Okay, we're going to have to end here because we're out of time. But this is a good spot to pick it up next week, unless something happens that diverts us. And I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you, Professor Montero. Thank you very much. And we'll speak with you again next week.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.